I didn't have to think very long for an appropriate illustration with which to open this message about finding satisfaction in life. It was Blaise Pascal who said once, "All men seek happiness. This is without exception. Whatever different means they employ, they all tend to this end. The will never takes the least step but to this object," meaning happiness. "This is the motive of every action of every man, even of those who hang themselves." I'm sure you're familiar with what happened recently, the suicide of the comic actor Robin Williams. Robin Williams was a man who, by every earthly standard, had it all. He had a net worth at his death of over $130 million. He had a career that placed him among Hollywood's most beloved actors, starring in popular movies, children's movies, Happy Feet, Aladdin, Night in the Museum, Hook, as well as dramas, Good Morning Vietnam, Awakening. He was a graduate of Juilliard School in New York. He was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, won one for Best Supporting Actor. He held a number of other awards that were given to him, indicating both a popularity among the people as well as a critical respect. And unlike many rich men, he was a man who was not miserly, not known for being miserly. He supported 28 charities. He gave 100% of the proceeds from his shows in 2010 to the victims of the earthquake in New Zealand. He made 5 trips to the Middle East and Afghanistan, where he entertained our troops with the USO. He was a man who, above all, in the world's eyes, was someone who was able to get people to laugh, even in the worst of circumstances. He had a family. He had 3 children. He had 3 wives, but he also had 3 children. Tragically, as you know, 20 days ago, Robin Williams died on August 11, 2014, in his home in California, at the age of 63. He committed suicide, reportedly battling severe depression for years. His life and his death illustrate to us that you can have everything that this world wars to own and yet have no satisfaction. The Rolling Stones sang it years ago, "I try and I try and I try and I try, but I can't get no. I can't get no satisfaction." Well, the author of Ecclesiastes, who we have been calling Kohelet by his name, his title, is writing 3,000 years ago, long before Robin Williams existed, long before the Rolling Stones, to a culture that's very different from our own, to a nation half a world away, to young people who are striving for success in society in a booming economy. And we realize, as we think about this, how much the human heart has not changed in 3,000 years and over all this space. Robin Williams' life, the Rolling Stones songs, are contemporary illustrations of the very same truth that we're going to see in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and chapter 6 today. If there has ever been a text that is an indictment of our culture's view on money and success, it is this text today. We live in a society of people today that can't get no satisfaction no matter how hard they try and try and try and try. This morning our text is a bit long, so rather than read it up front, what I'll do is comment as we go along. We'll read it and I'll comment as we go along. We're going to look at almost 2 chapters of text here, a text that employs a favored Near Eastern form of rhetoric called a chiasm. And it's different from our Western style of understanding. We tend to think linearly. We develop a story, it hits a climax, and then there's a resolution to that story. Well, this is a chiasm is named after the Greek letter chi, or chi, which is an X. And it kind of, if you want to picture it, it's like a pyramid. Okay, we're going to take steps up from both ends of the climax. The climax is in the middle, and we're going to see this text developing on both sides of the climax. Imagine, again, like a pyramid, we're moving up step by step toward the pinnacle being the climax of the text. In a chiasm, the steps on one end correspond to the steps on the other side. So today what I'm going to do is kind of take this Near Eastern method of literature and kind of even it out for you. We're going to arrive at the climax last, but we're going to do it from both sides. As you see, we're going to go through the text on both ends. So I'm kind of taking it and flattening it out for our Western understanding with something, a way that we're more used to. We'll open up this text discussing it in four points. There's first a brief preliminary point which will acclimate us to the setting that we're in. He's going to make the observation that we are in reality in a wicked world. And we'll see that in chapter 5, verses 8 and 9 on one end, and chapter 6, verses 10 to 12 on the other. From there, the three main points of the text. First, people who pursue wealth are not satisfied. People who pursue wealth are not satisfied. And we'll see that in chapter 5, verses 10 to 12, and chapter 6, verses 7 to 9. Again, working upward, working together toward that climax. Thirdly, we'll see the evil of not enjoying life in chapter 5, verses 13 to 17, and in chapter 6, verses 1 to 6. And then the climax, the main focus of the text, an admonition to enjoy God's daily gifts in chapter 5, verses 18 to 20. That's the central proclamation and the conclusion. This is the final text for us today in the first half of the book of Ecclesiastes. This is marks the midpoint. This is the end of Act 1. The curtain closes and we have an intermission before we go into Act 2 of Ecclesiastes the next time we're together. Now, if you remember last time, we had that heavy dose of imperatives, 9 commands in 7 verses, the first 7 verses of chapter 5. But most of our time in Ecclesiastes has, most of the first half, Act 1, has been consumed with Kohelet's reflections on life, the realities, the perplexities of life. In our text today, Kohelet is going to return to this reflective mood now. He's going to draw upon samples of life, examples of futility and of emptiness, of an existence consumed with the pursuit of comfort and riches. And his first point, really, is to say that people who pursue wealth will not be satisfied. And we're going to see that when we get to chapter 5, verses 10 to 12. But before he makes that argument that people pursue wealth, who pursue wealth will not be satisfied, he takes a step back and he's going to remind us of the whole system that we're in here. He's going to make this observation about the world. Before he makes the observation about life and riches, he's going to make this observation about the environment that we're in. So look at chapter 5 of Ecclesiastes, beginning in verse 8. He says, if you see in a province, the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. Kohelet here is revisiting something he said earlier about the injustice of a wicked world. When you see oppression of the poor, when you see slavery, when you see children and women who are sold into sex trafficking, when you see oppressive regimes that are killing innocents, when you observe these things, Kohelet is saying here, don't be amazed. He's not really even saying here, do something about it. That's not his purpose. He's saying, don't be amazed at the matter. This is the world in which we live. This is life. Do not expect it to be any better in this fallen place. He tells us why that's the case in verse 8 when it comes to governments and injustice in nations. In verse 8 he says, for the high official is watched by a higher, and yet higher ones over them. So he's laying the blame for the wickedness of governments on the authority, the haves who oppress the have-nots, the highest officials who are all looking out for themselves, all trying to protect themselves rather than protect the poor, rather than to protect the very individuals they have been appointed and elected to protect. Caring for themselves. There's someone high and someone higher watching over him, even while they fleece the poor and they violate justice. Now, this is not to suggest there's anything noble about being poor, because the fact of the matter is that even the poor would oppress someone if they were given authority over someone. The problem is they're at the bottom of the bottom of the ladder, so there's no one to step on. But if they were given authority, they would oppress too. In verse 9, he tells us, however, that even though there are rulers who abuse authority, that in a nation we're still better off with an authority than to have no ruler at all. Look at verse 9. He says, but this is gain for a land in every way. So there's a but there. He's contrasting this. But this is gain for a land in every way. A king committed to cultivated fields. What he's saying here in this text is, look, we're under the sun. And under the sun in this world, as a result of the fall of man, we need human authorities. Though those human authorities are fallen, though they are sinful, though they are out after themselves, we need them to oversee and to govern a wicked nation's actions. And overall, we learn from this that even though rulers, we need leaders and we need rulers and we need those in authority, they are just as wicked as anyone. And it may be a vanity, but it's true. That's the way we are. Don't be amazed, he's saying it. Don't be amazed when you see this. When you see the next politician to come on the news, or the next religious leader who's found abusing his authority, why are you surprised? Why would we be surprised when the best of men fall? Sometimes we act as if men who are in leadership are not men. Governors, senators, presidents, CEOs, pastors, dictators share one thing in common. They are all fallen people. And it should not surprise us when we hear, as many of you heard this week, of one pastor who has fallen into adultery. Or should it surprise us, as we've heard this week, of another pastor who was accused of being a bully in his church and asked to step down? It ought not surprise us, brothers and sisters, because this is the condition of man under the sun. Ultimately, though, we don't look to human leaders. God is showing us through these illustrations of life that we look to one who Isaiah prophesied as a child born, a son given, the one who bears the government on his shoulders. His name is called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government, his authority, his rulership, there is no end. That's the one to whom we look. Now let's go across the pyramid now to chapter 6. Turn over to chapter 6 and let's look at the parallel in this chiasm of verses 10 to 12 of chapter 6. Ecclesiastes 6, verse 10 and 10 to 12. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity. And what is the advantage to man? And who knows what is good? For man, while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow, for who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? This is just a brutally realistic view of life. Man is what he is. Who knows what good is going to come after a man dies? Even if a man is good for a season, even if a leader is good for a season, that person is going to pass like a shadow, and who knows what's going to come after him. This sets the stage. And it's important, again, to acclimate our understanding, that we understand when it comes to how we deal with money and riches, that we realize the reality of the world that we are in. We tend to ignore realities. We tend to turn away from evil. We have this wicked dichotomy. We're so wicked. We have this dichotomy that relishes, on one hand, looking at evil. If you ever want evidence of that, be in a traffic jam where on the other side of the road someone's pulled over and everyone has to stop and see what's going on. But yet, on the other hand, we don't want that evil to come too close to us, because God forbid it's me who's on that ground, bleeding. We tend at times to voyeuristically celebrate the demise of others while seeking to escape death ourselves. And that's the truth, and that's the whole truth, and that's nothing but the truth, and that is the truth about you, and it is the truth about me. And the truth is, we will not escape death, we will all die, and we will not know what comes after. And that is not a popular message. It's kind of anticlimactic when you think about the fact that this is the halfway point. That's the end of chapter 6. So you're right there at the halfway point. The curtain closes on that thought. There's your intermission. The curtain closes on Act 1 of this two-act drama of Ecclesiastes exposing the condition of mankind under the sun. There is no good because all is temporary. All is fading away. There are no practical certainties where I can plan for. It's no wonder people don't want to tackle this book. It's kind of a hopeless report that it leaves us with. Let's look at the second point in our text as we move backward now through this chiasm. In this wicked, hopeless world in which we live, there are people who still pursue happiness. Even in the midst of wickedness, people are looking for something to make them happy. And first on the list of those pursuits is money. Give me money. As long as we're on that side of the pyramid, let's work our way up from chapter 6. Look at verses 7 and 9. Working backwards here. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and striving after wind. People who pursue wealth will not be satisfied with wealth. Talks about those who have a wandering appetite. The picture here is of a man who is living for his cravings. In this case, it's talking about literal food, that which he eats. He says the toil of a man's mouth is for his mouth. In other words, the mouth or the belly is his master. He compulsively works in order to compulsively eat. But his appetite is not satisfied. Why? Because he wakes up hungry and the next morning comes. And he's hungry the next day and he's got to fill himself again. By implication, this extends to all appetites. Man works in order to feed his fleshly indulgences, that which would make him happy, whether it is food or drink or drugs or sex or vacations or retirement or some other pleasure. He runs this industrial treadmill of life so that he can spend what he has on himself. Who can't be touched by this, brethren? I ask, is anyone exempt from this? Is anyone exempt from the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh and covetousness? This is what did in our earliest ancestors. Adam and Eve were deceived by a carnal desire, that beautiful forbidden fruit that resulted in death. Are we to say I'm wiser than they? Are we to think that we're wiser than Adam and Eve? Kohelet anticipates an objection in verse 9. He says, "For what advantage has the wise man over the fool?" And it's a rhetorical question, and the expected answer is none. What advantage is wisdom over folly? None. The wise has no advantage over the fool when it comes to his appetite, because neither the wise nor the fool are ever satisfied. So even if you want to say, I'm wiser than Adam and Eve, you still have the same appetites. One might expect the wise to have an advantage. Well, they can go to school. They can make more money. The fool is always going to be poor, but their advantage is temporal at best. Ultimately, wisdom and folly are leveled in death. Anyway, both the wise and the fool end up in the grave. So there's no advantage, ultimately, to being wise. In fact, to the contrary, you might be surprised that there is an advantage to not being rich. The fact that the poor enjoy a benefit that the rich do not have. Look at verse 9. It continues. It says, what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. What he's saying is the poor man behave better than the rich because the poor are living by the sight of their eyes instead of living for a hopefully fulfilled appetite. They're not driven by a wandering appetite that the rich have. Why? Because appetites come through tasting. You know something is good because you've tasted of that. See, I have no appetite for snails because I've never eaten snails. You can say, oh, Pastor Joe, you don't know what you're missing. It's so good. You know, many of you eat sushi. You know, I just don't have an appetite for it. It might be wonderful. I might be missing out on the best thing in the world. But you know what? I have no appetite for it. So I'm quite satisfied to never eat snails or never eat sushi. I'm satisfied. Why? Because I never tasted it. I'm not missing anything. So it is with the poor. They're satisfied, for they've not tasted of that which the rich have and tasted of and then want more of. They're content with what they have, even if it is just their daily bread. That's their advantage. That's what he's saying, their advantages. Now let's look across the pyramid, go back to chapter 5, and we'll look at verses 10 to 12. And they give us the very same report. This is the corresponding step here of this second point. Ecclesiastes 5, verses 10 to 12. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of the laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. We see here again the rich and the poor contrasted. Or better, really, not so much the rich and the poor, but rather the lover of money. We even saw that in our reading this morning. It identified the Pharisees as lovers of money. We're contrasting here the lover of money with the laborer who works, who's content with his wages. And again, just like the observation over on the other side of the pyramid, we see here poor laborers have an advantage over the rich, over the lovers of money. I'll use the word rich, but realize what I mean by that is not so much having the money as much as coveting that money, loving that money. For while we see the rich man loses sleep, why? Because he has anxiety over what he's anxious about keeping what he has. He has this full stomach and he wants to keep it full. So he loses sleep, worrying. The laborer, on the other hand, sleeps sweetly. His head hits the pillow at night. He's not occupied with what's going to happen the next day. How am I going to hold on to my riches? How am I going to survive? He just knows I need to rest tonight because tomorrow I need to work to earn another day's wage. If I'm going to work well tomorrow, let me sleep tonight. And then we have this pithy statement in verse 10 that summarizes the whole point. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This is vanity. How enigmatic, ironic a reality is that the more you have, the more you want. If you love money, you will never be satisfied. You will always want more. As has been said of J.D. Rockefeller, when asked how much would be enough, he said just a little more. It has to do with appetites. You taste it and you want more of it. Turn to 1 Timothy, the New Testament. 1 Timothy, the New Testament teaches us the very same thing about riches. 1 Timothy chapter 6 uses even the same language as Ecclesiastes. Appetites, cravings, desires. 1 Timothy 6 verse 9. Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, and it's through its craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. Whether you're rich or poor here today, same is true. The one who loves money will not be satisfied with money. That's just it. So if you're a Christian here today, be careful where you set your affections. Be careful, because God permits the very riches that you would trust in to bring about the ruin of those who are owned by them. God permits the very riches that people trust in to bring about the ruin of those who are owned by them. If you're owned by your riches, God would even permit those riches to disappoint you. See, material gain is something that very few know how to deal with. The reason why I believe so many Christians are not rich is really God's grace upon the believers. Because truth be told, as evidenced by those many Christians that end up being rich and then going out into all these prosperity circles, the reason is God's grace. Because for many of us, riches would plunge us into ruin. Cravings would cause some of us even to wander from the faith. So next time you think about, why am I poor? Think about it as being God's grace upon you. Verse 11, go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 11. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. What he's saying here is, whatever you gain, you're going to lose. Anyway, no matter what, you're going to lose it. Even if death is the final taker of it, you're going to lose it. Somewhere, someone, whether it's an insect like a moth that's going to eat your clothes, whether it's oxygen in the air that's going to rust your metal objects, whether they're thieves that are going to come in and steal your possessions, or stock markets, or economies that crash, or covetous men who just want a little bit of piece of your action. The contractor who comes to fix up your home and then makes a mess of it. The landscaper who wants to tend your garden. The maid who's going to clean your house. The nanny who's going to watch your children. Everyone wants to get their cut. There are countless numbers of places where you can spend your money and lose your money. That's why verse 11 says, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner, he says, but to see with his eyes? In other words, when you own something, what's your advantage if it's going to be gone anyway, but to see it with your eyes, to enjoy it in that moment? That's the only advantage there is. What advantage does increasing goods have? Is it like the world says, so that you can die with the most toys in the end? Is there any advantage to that? Is it that you can look forward to a wonderful retirement package? Is that the reason why we should? Is that the advantage of accumulating goods? No. He's saying is the only advantage to increasing goods is that you have it for that moment. You see it with your eyes. That's it. You can see it now in the present so that you can enjoy it now in the present, because tomorrow it may very well likely be gone. And you know what? The laborer knows this. The laborer knows how to enjoy the fruit of his labor. The rich man is often devising ways of holding on to what he has. And he loses sleep as he sees the economy failing. And he looks at the reality and he sees, hey, this is something that I could lose. Kohelet's case study reveals that a life lived in pursuit of material gain is twice spoiled. First in the gaining and then in the losing. Commentator Derek Kidner makes an interesting observation about our culture, which is consumed with exercise machines and health clubs and all this. He writes this: it's one of human absurdities to pour out money and effort just to undo the damage of money and ease. In other words, we make money to fill our bellies and gain weight, and then we spend that money in health clubs to work off what we gain. If there ever was a vanity of vanities, right? Okay, let's take this next step up the pyramid. We're in chapter 5. Let's look at chapter 5, verses 13 to 17, and then we'll look across the way at chapter 6, verses 1 to 6. First, chapter 5, verses 13 to 17. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son who has nothing in his hand. And he came from his mother's womb. And he shall go again naked as he came. And he shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, he shall go. And what gain is there to him who toils for wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. We have here, he's giving us a mini case history of this man. Okay, this rich man. A man who's working for his money. He's gaining riches. But they have no benefit for him. He can't enjoy the riches that he gains. He works hard. He makes money. But he either loses it in a bad investment, or he gets sick, or he dies. And he leaves the world as he came in, naked. Just as he came into the world, he goes out of the world. He takes nothing with him. Proverbs chapter 23, verses 4 and 5 instruct. It says, do not toil to acquire wealth. Be discerning enough to desist. When your eyes light on it, it's gone. For it suddenly sprouts wings, flying like an eagle toward heaven. When you set your eyes on wealth, don't land on it, because it's going to fly away. And Colette says this is a grievous evil of life. Literally, that means a sickening or a deadly evil. Not only are we wasting our lives toiling away for what in the end has no value, but to make matters worse, even when you get what you have, you can't enjoy it. That's even worse. Turn to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. Reading the case history reminded me of the rich fool in Jesus' parable where Jesus warns of covetousness. Luke chapter 12, I want to look at verse 15 to 21. Jesus is warning the disciples about the danger of covetousness and the end of covetousness. Luke 12, verse 15. And he said to them, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. For one's life does not consist of the abundance of his possessions. And he told a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there will be store for all my grain and all my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. It is the fool who tries to amass material things, because whether he loses them in this life or not, there is going to be a day when he has an appointment with Mr. Death. And at that time, even if he should gain the whole world, nothing will buy him one iota of any life when he forfeits his very soul. And we saw this because on August 11, 2014, sometime just before noon, a man who had everything in this world, who by every earthly standard was good, benevolent man, an Academy Award winner, multi-millionaire, man who made the world laugh, had his soul required of him. And none of all that he had on earth mattered to him at that point. As beloved as he was to this world, as big as his life was in this world, he stood small and he stood humbled before God. As perhaps for the first time in his existence, he came to the full realization that though he was a man who was given many gifts, that he enjoyed none of it in life. As he came from his mother's womb, he went again. Naked as he came, he took nothing for his toil. Just as he came into the world, he went. Since we've discovered about Robin Williams, really true of any person that is outside of Christ, that he is this man that Kohelet describes. Look at verse 17. Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. We think of a man, we think of a smile, we think of a laugh. Now we know of the pain that was under all of that. Eating in darkness, in much vexation, sickness, and anger. No matter how much of this world you have, it will not satisfy. It will not take the place of vexation and sickness and anger that the one who is separated from Christ has and lives. This world is filled with inconsolable longings, seeking to satisfy in life through stuff, exotic vacations, sporting extravaganzas, or drugs, or alcohol, or sex, or gambling, or workaholism, or charitable works, or family. C.S. Lewis wrote, we are half-hearted creatures fooling around with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us like an ignorant child who want to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by an offer of a holiday at the sea. He says, we are far too easily pleased. We're pleased making mud pies. So in the end of it all, the miser ends up alone in his misery. The covetous dies, never having made enough. The rich suffers from heart disease or high blood pressure or ulcers, worrying about his riches. The more we have, the more we hurt ourselves trying to hold on to what we have. The more we have, the more we have to lose in the end. And the more we have, the more we leave behind to someone else. C.S. Lewis observed also, he said, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that it was made for another world. If there's something that is not satisfied by the things of this world, it tells us that we are made for another world. So I would ask you today, if you're hearing this and you're not trusting in Christ, you're trusting maybe in your religion, maybe your good works, maybe you think that one day you'll stand before God and explain to him how you were a good person in life and you deserve to go to heaven. And today you're living apart from Christ, not understanding the gospel, not trusting his finished work on your behalf. Today you might be living for your religion. Today you might be living for your own good works. Or today you might be running away from anything good, seeking to find satisfaction in sin. I would say to you, what is it that you think is going to bring satisfaction to your life? And I'll add to that, have you ever found anything that comes remotely close? Has anything been able to bring any sense of satisfaction in this world to you? I would call you then to consider your estate and turn from whatever empty philosophy or method or religion that you are trusting in and rest upon the finished work of Christ, for Christ alone satisfies. Why spend all the days of your life in some vanity? Why eat in darkness with vexation and sickness and anger? Why play with mud pies when the most beautifully satisfying person was born of a virgin 2,000 years ago? 2,000 years ago, the Word became flesh and dwelled among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And you are called today to look upon him, the glorious one who today is dwelling at the right hand of the Father, where the Psalms tell us our pleasures forevermore. If you would come to him today, you will find life and you will find that for which your soul is craving. Come to him and find life. The steadfast love of the Lord is better than life. Psalm 63:3 tells us. And to you, brothers and sisters who are in Christ, I would ask you, how often are you tempted by these very same things, the things of this world? How often has your own anger, sickness, or vexation been caused by an excess love for the things in this world? Have you ever gotten sick because of anxiety over what you have or what you don't have? When husbands and wives get angry at each other over how much they spend, typically in that first year of marriage, you get into those discussions about who's spending on what. Is it really about biblical stewardship? Or are you fighting over what you have or what you want? How about your wife? How about your countenance? Does it sing, I can't get no satisfaction? You walk around the world and everyone sees you and says, that person can't get satisfaction in life. Brethren, may our song instead be that of the old hymn writer who said, I tried the broken cisterns, ah, but how the waters failed. Even as I stooped to drink, they fled and mocked me as I wailed. The pleasures lost, I sadly mourned, but never wept for thee, till grace my sightless eyes received, thy loveliness to see. Christ, in thee my soul hath found, and found in thee alone, the peace, the joy I sought so long, the bliss till now unknown. Christ holds the key to your satisfaction. How much better a song that is then I can't get no satisfaction. But I try and I try and I try and I try. Brethren, when will we come to the realization that Augustine came to when he said, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts find no peace until they rest in you." You know, God may give you many gifts and many talents, many possessions even. He may give you money. He may give you good things like family and friends and children. But what good is it all if you're discontent, if you can't enjoy it? Koheleth makes this point. He says, that's evil. It's a grievous, deadly evil that you would even have something in this life and not enjoy what you have. Look over chapter 6, verses 1 to 6, the other side of the pyramid. He says, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It's a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he has no burial, I say that a stillborn is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to one place. Here is another case study, another rich man here. But this rich man is given gifts by God that he can't enjoy. He's discontent with what he has. Notice, Koheleth identifies God as the giver of the blessing. See, he says, God is the source of it. And this man has everything that he desires. And Solomon is saying God gave him wealth, possessions, honor, many children, long life. But take note in verse 2 why he can't enjoy it. It says, notice, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them. Whatever it is, whether the man is consumed with his riches, maybe he's anxious about it, maybe something else, take note, it says God is the source, not only of the blessing, but the ability to enjoy that blessing comes from God. Not only does God give the gift, but God enables only some to whom he gives gifts to enjoy what they have and others not to. And this is a perplexing thing to Koheleth. He says, this is a vanity. This is a striving after wind. How do we get this? This man is, his soul is not satisfied with life's good things. And he says, you know what? I don't get this. A stillborn child is better off than he is. And that's shocking, by the way. That is shocking language, especially to the Jewish mindset in the Old Testament, where we see life as a gift. To have something that you can't enjoy in life is worse than never having had it at all. The Jewish people have a saying, L'chaim, means to life, but not only to life, it means to the enjoyment of life, to the well-being, to the prosperity of life. Life is a gift from God that he has given to you to enjoy. And sometimes as Christians, we forget this because we get wrapped up in the do's and don'ts of the faith. And we forget about God is the giver. Jesus said, I came to give life and life more abundantly. And the Westminster divines who framed the Westminster Catechism got it 100% right when they defined in the very first question and asked, what is the chief end of man? What is the chief end of man? The chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. If you want to boil down your place in the Bible, that is it. To glorify God and enjoy him forever. That's the message of Ecclesiastes. In this text, the preacher is warning. He's warning against pursuing wealth. The scriptures warn us against covetousness. We have the commandments, of course, in the book of Exodus that warns us against coveting. Ecclesiastes, as well as all the scripture, warn us against accumulating wealth and covetous living. But the main point here, that Qoheleth is saying, besides warning, is to point us how to live a satisfied and abundant life. Qoheleth takes us beyond thou shalt not covet, and he tells us, covet. Just don't covet the wrong things. See, we are taking delight in and desiring and seeking satisfaction in the wrong things. There is something you ought to covet, brethren. There is something for which you were put on earth to enjoy. And this is where our journey takes us up these two sides. Now we're at the pinnacle of this chiasm, the main point of the chiasm, the conclusion here. Okay, we've established the case studies. It's a wicked world. We see the double evil. The pursuit of money will not satisfy. We see the evil. No one can, people can't enjoy what they gain. The conclusion. How do we respond to all of this? How? Many in the world would say, oh, that's easy. The solution is run away from materialism. And this is the manner many respond to. This is the way they can't deal with the rat race. They don't want the, they recognize the evil of life's pressures that money puts on people, and it drives them to join a cult. Or to live in tents in public parks, as happened a couple of years ago. This is their response. But is that the response the preacher says here? No, not at all. In this text, the preacher issues the warning about pursuing wealth. But more than this, he says in this conclusion, enjoy God's daily provision. This is what the whole text points to as we come both sides up the ladder. This is the conclusion. It's not to be dissatisfied. Dissatisfaction characterizes the world. Satisfaction in God characterizes the Christian. God is at the heart of Qoheleth's message. Up to now, we have not heard much about God. But God is central to this teaching. Now that we've climbed the pyramid to the top of this chiasm, we've come up both sides, we meet in the center. What's the central proposition and conclusion and point of application of the text? Look at verses 18 to 20. Chapter 5. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. This is a gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with the joy of his heart. It's almost like a spiritual Alzheimer's. You know, the world is falling apart around us, but it doesn't all matter because you know Christ. He occupies the center of your joy. You could forget about everything else. I think that's the abundant life that Christ came to bring us. At the center of the abundant life, it's not about the abundance of things. That's the irony of all of these false teachers and prosperity and name it and claim it folk. The irony is they miss what abundance is. They're talking about abundance and they don't know what it is. Qoheleth's definition of abundance is that your appetite is satisfied, that you are filled with good things, that you find in day-to-day life God's daily provision, and you rejoice in that. You rejoice in His gifts that He's given you. Do you know that He has uniquely gifted you, every single one of you, in a different way? You can rejoice in that fact. Rejoice in the mundane things of life, food, drink, work. Brethren, enjoying that is not something that He has given to everyone. Enjoying the fruit of your work is not an evil thing. It's the other way around. To not enjoy it as God's gift, that is what He calls evil. The world has no power to enjoy these things as gifts from God. If you're not a believer in here and you just heard the pastor say, enjoy your work, what do you mean I wait for Friday afternoon so I don't have to work? But God is saying, you have in your toil, you have in your eating, you have in your drinking, you have in your fellowship, you have every day something to enjoy. The world has no power. They're either misers on the one hand or wanton spenders on the other. They can't approach wealth with the wisdom that God gives, with the wisdom that glorifies Him the way you can. Brethren, you've been set free from being a slave to wealth so that you as a Christian are free to enjoy it as a gift from God. Let me ask you something very practical here. Would you feel guilty if you were to take money that God has given you through your labor and go to a really nice restaurant or on a really nice vacation? If so, I would ask you, on what do you base that guilt? You'd say, well, surely there's many other things that are more important than going to a nice restaurant or on a nice vacation. And perhaps you're right. Or perhaps God might want to bless you with the taste of something that is so out of this world good, so unbelievably tasty, that you will not help but to glorify Him for not only creating that food, but gifting the chef who prepared it. Is that possible? Is it? Perhaps our asceticism is depriving us of one of the earthly manners that God has given us to enjoy Him forever, because forever starts today. Some of you might think, but that's not necessity and giving. All my money needs either to be necessity or giving. You know what? You're free to do that. As a Christian, you are 100% free to use your money on necessities and give away the rest. But I would add that the Christian should not feel guilty to use money outside of basic necessities. It is not less holy to do so. And in fact, that may be the very means that God uses to prompt worship in you by enjoying some of the wealth that He gives you simply by spending it on good things which God has created on earth for the pleasure of His people. Do you realize that God created a beautiful earth before man ruined it? And he's calling us to enjoy them now, even in the midst of all of the fallenness. You may say to me, you know what, I don't enjoy going to fine restaurants. I don't want to go on a nice vacation. Then I'd say to you, fine, don't do it. No one's saying you have to do it. But don't begrudge your brother or sister or try to hide your preference in some kind of pseudo-spirituality. Brethren, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And we do need to be aware of our attitudes towards it. But we need to be aware of our attitudes in making a God out of its use or its non-use. If God has given you something, whether it's a gift or a talent or money or possessions or family, you have to understand you cannot enjoy it if you are looking at that thing as an end to itself. If you're looking at that meal, at that fine restaurant, as an end to itself, if you're looking at your children as an end to themselves, I'm going to find my satisfaction in that meal. I'm going to find my satisfaction in my children. I'm going to find my satisfaction in owning that house. If that's the end of it, then you will not enjoy it. But to not enjoy what God has given you as truly a gift from Him is a grievous evil as well. Enjoy what God has given you, brethren. How? How do I do that? Not by focusing on the thing, but focusing on the Lord who gave it to you, enjoying it with that attitude of gratitude toward God. And notice here, the life that Kohelet is talking about is not just one of getting through and coping and just kind of squeezing through it. I got to accept my lot in life and get through it at the end and then I'll be happy. That's not what he's talking here. He's admonishing us. He's saying, be content, and yes, even rejoice in what you have. This is your chief end. This is why God created the world. And that's the irony of it. We live in a world that's fallen under the sun. God created it for His glory, and He puts everything in it to be enjoyed, but yet it's fallen, and no one can. But yet in Christ you can. Enjoy the things that God has given you. A man's passions are revealed by what he enjoys, brothers and sisters. What we value, we're going to put our time and our energy into. It was Charles Simeon on his deathbed when he was asked by a friend, what are you thinking? He said, I'm not thinking, I'm enjoying. On his deathbed, Charles Simeon said there are two lessons for the Christian to learn. The one is to enjoy God in everything. The other is to enjoy everything in God. And, you know, immediately when people hear this, they say, but what about sin? Of course he's not talking about that. You won't enjoy sin if you're enjoying God. But brethren, the experience of joy in God is something that our sinful hearts are unable to grasp. It goes against our nature to find joy in God, in the things of God. We are naturally bent to try to find joy in other things outside of God, in sinful things. That's what our sinful heart does. There is a reason that there needs to be a commandment in the Bible, thou shalt not covet. It is because we are bent towards coveting. There's a reason why we are commanded in the New Testament to rejoice. Why do we need to be commanded to rejoice? Because we are bent to not rejoice in our fallen condition. So, listen, you have no independent ability of yourself to choose God over money. This is not something that you could say apart from grace. If you did not have the grace of God and you were given the choice to serve God and serve money, you will 100% of the time choose money, guaranteed. That's why Jesus came. Jesus left heaven, he came to earth, he dwelled among us, he died for lovers of money, just like you and just like me. So while you come to this completely hopeless in yourself, realize that in your heart, God, if you're in Christ, God has given you the grace to choose the pleasure of God over the fleeting pleasures of this world. That grace is available to you, brothers and sisters. When God changes your heart, he takes out a heart of stone, he puts in a heart of flesh. That heart of flesh craves worship, craves God, craves him. What the things of this world can give fall so short. It longs for a day when we will worship and enjoy him forever. That new heart that you have in the gospel is not going to be filled with the things of the world. And as you find in that heart that you will not be filled with the things of the world, that your only desire is to worship God, and even in the good things that he gives you, that is authentic worship. Then you are worshiping God in spirit and in truth. That's the essence of our worship. It's being deeply satisfied in God. True worship is reached when we are convicted that our pursuit for satisfaction has assembled us together to get to glorify God. Why are you here today in church? Why? You're here together today. God has assembled us together to glorify him. And if your mind is, I would rather be in Tahiti right now, or I would rather be... You all have your own, I'm sure, your own fantasy land of where you'd... If that's it, then God is not being glorified as maximally as he ought. Jonathan Edwards said, God is glorified not only by his glories being seen, but being rejoiced in. So today, as we gather together, you have an opportunity to come together and worship God. And that is exciting. If we do not rejoice in God and find our ultimate satisfaction in him, we're not glorifying him as we ought. And this has led, of course, John Piper to famously conclude, and I think rightly conclude, God is most glorified when we are most satisfied in him. God is most glorified when we are most satisfied in him. You know, I never in a million years thought I would ever find myself agreeing with Joel Osteen, or let alone Victoria Osteen. Okay, here's where half the people leave the church. Those of you who know what Victoria Osteen said this week, there's a bit of truth in what she said. For those who don't know, she basically said, some of it is absurd, but she said basically we're assembled together for worship for God. Some people think about it that way, but she said, I want you to worship God for yourself. Do good to others for yourself, because God is happy when you're happy. The truth in this is that if you're here today to worship God and you're satisfied being here, indeed God is pleased. Today, if you are happy for the opportunity to worship God, then yes, God is pleased. But you see, the thing of it is that it doesn't end with you, that your happiness is not an end to itself. See, when God's people are persuaded that there is no other place that I want to be on earth than worshiping God, He is greatly exalted in that. No pleasure, no vacation spot, no pursuit, no football game, no baseball game, no family event, no job, no sporting event, no friends, not the shore, not the boardwalk, not here, not there. No place can replace the joy that I have, that I am experiencing as I worship God. This makes God more central to our worship. And if we get to that place, brethren, then we are enjoying God and we are beginning to glorify Him forever. This is what Kohelet is admonishing us to get to that place, brethren, where we enjoy Him forever.